Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, friends. If you listen to that song every day, you'll have no fractured failures in your life. You'll have victory in every circumstance. Catch it on YouTube under Michael Milvanigam's post. So tonight I'm doing part two of this dramatic event. Headline news can be deceptive, friends, and when you're in the limelight, there's a shadow with every prism. So last night, John, Bob, and I lightly touched upon Larry Elder's personal life, and I wasn't necessarily trying to attack him. It's just that I was trying to measure his philosophical stance versus what he practices in his real life. Now, I'm not making any claims to fame. I was a personal friend of Larry's for a brief time. He has a lot of friends and fans, and I wasn't a loyalist in the sense where I completely embraced everything he said. In fact, I'm going to bring up a topic right now that really irked me one day. A couple of years ago, when The Help was up for the Oscar, Larry was praising Meryl Streep after the Oscars, saying what an incredible actress she was, how she always stands the test of time. And then on his same radio show that day, in the post-Oscar radio show, he played his song, "Who Let the Dogs Out? Woo, woo. Woo, 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 who let the dogs out?" And he played it in relationship to Viola Davis, who was one of the black women who played a key role in the movie The Help. Now, I don't know. It seems like throughout time, he's always standing on the sides. He's always glorifying the white race and recessively criticizing his own race, putting high standards to the test. So this is my proposition. If the woman that he's engaged to, named Alexandra Dayteig, if she was a black woman who had engaged in prostitution and then weaved her way out of that lifestyle by doing the same thing Alexandra did, by busting Heidi Fleiss and cooperating with the police and showing credit card receipts and examples of how this hiring prostitution ring existed. Would Larry martyr that black woman in the same fashion that he's indirectly doing by being engaged to a former hooker? Now, my only proposition here is that this Heidi Fleiss thing went down 20 years ago in 1993, 21 to be exact. Time has passed, and as Bob mentioned on the radio show last night, it is no longer front page news. Therefore, if someone was a hooker and allowed herself to have her body be used for sin by men exploiting her, and then one incident in which Alexandra Datig said that a man somehow, it would be situations where Heidi Fleiss would arrange for a hooker to get a airline ticket and several thousand dollars cash per day. And sometimes men took them to different remote places. But in one case, just one case only, she got stuck with someone who would put her in a he put her in a hotel room for 3 days. I guess he would come in and pull her hair and slap her up and then leave. Now, I don't know how many times this happened in a three-day period, but she was abused in that situation. However, she didn't go to the cops. What she eventually did is she just turned Heidi Fleiss in because Heidi became a grappling person in her life, but not by not directly allowing her to leave the prostitution lifestyle. In other words, Heidi Fleiss felt like she owned the woman. Now, I do think Heidi Fleiss is an ungodly woman full of selfishness, greed, and pride. And she's currently reforming the chicken ranch and that prostitution set up in Nevada. And I don't admire a person like that at all. She most likely did exploit women under her belt. And furthermore, Alexandra Datig was only 20 years old when she entered into this. Now, according to internet sources, she was from Switzerland, so being the fact that she was a European in an American country, probably not with a lot of clout, you know, I can understand how she got sucked into a prostitution ring, but even myself coming to Los Angeles at 27 as a married woman with a spouse and having some security, it was a hard place to make it, but I still don't foresee myself as being dumb enough to get involved in a prostitution ring. Now, Alexandra Datig, when she was 20, was very beautiful and thin. And she probably, I don't know what her background was. I don't know if she was raised in the church. I don't know if she didn't have common sense. But a lot of women are suckered into that prostitution situation. Maybe it's not something as overt as a high-class prostitution ring. Maybe it's just a sugar daddy who they sleep with that they're not really in love with. Who knows? Anyways, John just texted us, and I guess he can't get out of his dog-sitting gig to join the show tonight. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to elaborate on some I looked up all my old emails from Larry. I saved them. I guess I was in a period of my life in early January of 2011. My father had died in August of 2010, and I did receive an inheritance in the early part of 2011. Now, the Lord blessed me, and I didn't have to struggle after that for a long time. Until recently. And I don't know, a few cracks that Larry made in the emails were kind of disturbing. I did tell him that I did get an inheritance, and he does commercial spots for Valley View Casino and Resort. And on this one particular weekend, he went there and he told me he had been there the whole weekend. And he said, just think, we could have blown through your $100,000 in one shot. Now, I still have these emails because Facebook sends email alerts to Yahoo, and I happen to save them, but To him, $100,000 might be a 2-week gig, but for me, it was a lifetime of waiting after I had struggled myself. And in 2000, I had to live in a homeless shelter for a while for battered women because I had been working at the Beverly Hills Medical Plaza. And then what happened was I moved back to the Midwest in the winter of 2000 because I got sick of living in a hotel. My twin sister, I was living with her around La Brea and Melrose, but she got a job transfer down to Torrance, and I was temping at the Beverly Hills Medical Plaza, so I stayed at the Vineland Lodge in Hollywood, and I had to take 3 buses and my 1.5-year-old through 3 bus transfers a day to get to work. I just kind of got sick of it, so I went to go live with my ex-boyfriend in Baldwin, Wisconsin, and he pushed my son one day, and he kind of pushed me because I decided I didn't want to sleep with him when I first moved back. So I had to go live in a shelter in Minneapolis, and I stayed at that shelter for quite a while, and then I moved to a Native American shelter in St. Paul. And in the meantime, I had found a job at the Minneapolis Library, and I started out at about 35 hours a week, and then my hours got cut to 17, so eventually I went back to California in June and decided it was a bad move. But I've had my series of struggles too, but I felt like my personality changed around Larry, that I was trying to impress them, and I didn't like that attitude. So in a certain kind of way, I was pimping myself. Now, I also told him about the 6 months I spent in North Carolina as an exchange student, being the only white person on campus. So I had engaged what Alexandra Dayton had done at age 20. I was in the South trying to change the world. My goal in life was to be a civil rights leader. I was born 20 years too late. But now that we see the Ferguson, Missouri trial unfolding, maybe I wasn't. But in that timely circumstance, I told Larry about how I lived 6 months at North Carolina Central in the dorms, being the only white person actually living on campus. There were some like 50 white students that commuted to the campus by car every day. And I was kind of pimping myself in the sense that I was telling him about my achievements in life. But that's what you do when you kind of get sucked into the celebrity world. You know, it's not that Larry Elder was even... The only thing I really enjoyed about his show is that he was funny and that he made light of certain things that most people take seriously, but he did it in a way that he could spin off his intellectual wit with the point he was trying to make. So there was a time in 2010 and 2011 where I only got AM, and I couldn't listen to NPR. So I listened to Larry and John Phillips and Doug McIntyre and a couple others. So I actually like John Phillips' humor a lot more, and he's actually a lot more direct without mincing words and trying to put forth certain protocol. I feel like Larry is kind of a traitor to his own race, the way that he criticizes Tavis Smiley and Al Sharpton. And even if he doesn't agree with people philosophically, I just some of the stuff he does is tasteful and some of the stuff isn't. I managed to become good enough friends with him to attend his father's funeral. There was nothing shady about our so-called cyber romance or friendship. I wasn't trying to get in his pants necessarily, and he wasn't trying to hit on me. We did plan a lunch at Cantor's. I've read through my emails, but it didn't materialize because I was student teaching at the time, and it just wasn't going to happen. And that's why I decided to go meet him at the Reagan Library with my friend. Later, I think it was around May of 2011 or June, where he gave a speech. No, it was fun and everything, but you know, the one thing I noticed about even that situation is a public event, you know, people always have to put on certain airs and they're not real. And the only famous person I met who was super real was Nellie Olson from Little House on the Prairie and Al Franken. Those are like the two most real celebrities I ever met. Now, my pastor from Wisconsin who relocated to California, his daughter dated Angelina Jolie's brother. And I guess James Haven was a pretty cool, nice person in real life, but my pastor was able to meet the whole, you know, Jolie family. And I guess they're pretty real, too. Now, the reason I put the headline of Victocrat versus Aristocrat in the byline of my radio show tonight is that when I first got the news that he was dating an ex-call girl who called herself being a human trafficking victim, is because when people think of human trafficking, they think that of 14 to 16-year-olds who are whisked away from hometowns or seduced into the black market of sex, either by an email or some type of electronic stimulation, you know, where they're blindly told something, or they might be promised something falsely and then they disappear, and then they're stuck in some kind of bondage where they have to sleep with older men and have sexual intercourse over and over. So that's my perception of human trafficking. Being whisked into a high-profile sexual ring where you have high-end customers, and even if you are 20 years old, I don't know, she could have run away at some point. She could have taken that $10,000 and moved to Nevada or Oregon or Sacramento. She didn't have to stay. She had a way out. Now, I'm glad that she's doing public service work for California, in the sense I believe she was involved with a study of the effects of marijuana and plant growing in Northern California, as well as doing service work for sexual exploitation. And that's all fine and good. It's just that, I don't know, I've had certain encounters with celebrities where the whole phoniness and mantra of their being is whisked away. My only stake in this matter is the situation that I had with Larry and some of his finer-tuned faults about how he exploits his own race, in the sense that he sets very high standards for how a black person should behave. And he's rooted in his own pride on his father, but his father's not the only hardworking person that came to this country. Louis Rodriguez, who wrote the book Always Running, his father and family and mother as well lived in Watts, and they worked their fingers to the bone. But he doesn't walk around saying that he's the greatest person alive just because he had a working parent. He just kind of weaves those experiences into his writing. So there probably isn't a person who is worthy enough in Larry Elder's eyes of himself. But it would have to be a praise-oriented person who praised him for all his philosophical stances. Now, there have been occasions where he's become an attack dog, and I see in the media recently that he had to make some sort of overture of apology towards comments he made about Ferguson, Missouri. If people want to defend a black kid who's 18 years old, and they felt that was killed under auspice circumstances, then let them do it. Now, maybe they have dragged it on too far, but there's been a lot of mixed messages that have come out in the grand jury meetings. There's been testimony with Michael's friend and Darren Wilson's testimony I believe the kid's name who witnessed it also was Dorian, and I wrote an article about it in the Duluth News Tribune. But basically, there has been such bipolar testimony from the white side versus the black side. That's what's really dragged on this 100-day battle in Ferguson, Missouri, and that's courting the National Guard. And if people, you know, now it's winter there, there's snow there, it's been a cold start to the winter, and if people are laying their lives down on the line betting for a situation where they feel with integrity they know it's right, you can stand on the sidelines and criticize them, but it doesn't make you noble. So go ahead, Larry. Defend your white cracker brothers. I'm tired of this shit. Okay? Stand on the side of your own race for once. You're part of the struggle. You're not part of the solution. So I'm going to take a byline 5-minute break right now. And then I pretty much made my peace with this Alexandra Dating, who I felt like I was somewhat harsh with in one of my first episodes last night. So I'm going to play this song, and then we're going to move on to something else. Amen, bless, amen. So I did find a New York Times op-ed piece. That pretty much gives the rundown of what's going on in Ferguson. And the reason I'm ending the last 15 minutes of my show on this topic is because this is the epicenter of the political vitriol that's facing our country. Like, I heard a girl be quoted on NPR a while back that said, when you stop killing our sons and daughters, we'll stop protesting. Now, the New York Times has an excellent map, even of Michael Brown's journey from Ferguson Market and Liquors to Canfield Drive, where he was shot dead in his tracks. Now, I read Dorian's his friend's testimony, and I wrote an op-ed piece myself in the Duluth News Tribune in October. I'm a weekly columnist for the Reader Weekly. the bottom line is, and what I'm tying this into Larry Elder's Victocrat sense, I'm sure Larry Elder would call a black boy who's 18, who might have some emotional trouble, but is basically not a horrible child, getting shot in cold blood, he'll call that kid a Victocrat, but he won't call a straight-up hookah one. And I've already made my points on that subject. Michael Brown, an unarmed black child, teenager, was shot and killed on August 9th by Darren Wilson, a police officer. Now, what kind of nerve does it take for a grown man to kill a child? The grand jury is what's going to be determined the amount of retribution in this case. It's made up of, in this Ferguson, Missouri incident, it's made up of 9 whites and 3 blacks. Its task is to determine whether there's probable cause to believe Officer Wilson committed a crime, i.e., like excessive force. The grand jury, it does meet in private, accompanied by two prosecuting attorneys. I apologize. I have worked over 90 hours in the last week, and I'm not on my A game. What does the grand jury base its decision on? The prosecutor usually chooses the evidence that the grand jury will hear, but in this case, the grand jury was allowed to call witnesses and issue subpoenas, according to Susan McGraff, a law professor at St. Louis University who has followed the case extensively. Grand jurors view photographs, forensic evidence, and medical reports. Witnesses who have testified include people who saw the events and police officers who worked on the investigation. While it is unusual in grand jury proceedings for the defendant to be allowed to testify, Wilson did give testimony. I also remember the preliminary grand jury stuff was behind closed door. There was no media allowed. After hearing all the evidence, the grand jury will vote to determine whether there is probable cause to believe Officer Wilson committed a crime. If 9 of the 12 jurors agree, he will be indicted. And what indicted means is he will be charged, potentially. Michael Brown and Dorian Johnson left Ferguson Market and Liquors, a convenience store. Surveillance video shows Mr. Brown had stole some cigarillos. They head towards the homes, walking north on West Florissant Avenue. Then they turned right on Canfield Drive. They walked in the middle of the street, which is usually quiet that time of day. At 12:01 p.m., which is noon, Officer Darren Wilson arrives driving alone in his police car. Speaking through his window, he tells the two men to move away from the street. Mr. Brown and Officer Wilson began to scuffle. Forensic evidence reveals that Officer Wilson's guns were fired twice in the car, first striking Mr. Brown in the arm and missing him the second time. Mr. Brown runs away and Officer Wilson gets out of his car and pursues him on foot, continuing. Autopsies show that Mr. Brown had been shot at least 6 times. What part of the incidents are in dispute? Accounts differ on who started the altercation and whether there was a struggle for the officer's gun. Officer Wilson said that he was pinned in his vehicle and feared for his life while struggling over his gun with Mr. Brown. Now, let me just throw something in here quick. Let's just say there was a struggle, and Michael Brown ran away, which he did run a certain distance. I bet you if the officer had let him run farther after being shot in the arm, if he had just let Michael Brown run and then called for backup then and not shot anymore, then the situation could have been solved a lot more effectively. Now, Wilson said that Brown punched and scratched him repeatedly, leaving swelling on his face and cuts on his neck. I'm not sure about that, but I saw video footage tonight of the police station, and Wilson did have a swollen face. They didn't mention scratches on the video. Mr. Johnson, who was with Mr. Brown, said that Mr. Brown never reached for the gun. He said Officer Wilson tried to choke Mr. Brown, grabbed his arm to pull him into the car, and threatened to shoot. Officer Wilson has also said that Mr. Brown had been running toward him when he fired the fatal shots. Okay, why would he run toward him? I don't know. Some witnesses say that Mr. Brown appeared to be surrendering with his hands in the air when he was killed. How many investigations are underway? At least three. The St. Louis County Grand Jury began hearing evidence on the shooting August 20th and is expected to reach a decision this month whether to indict him. If they don't indict this person, there is going to be hell to pay. That's not in the article, by the way. Remember what happened to Rodney King in that trial? There were riots because they let four white police officers off. The FBI opened a civil rights inquiry into the shooting on August 11th. It was August 9th, New York Times. Officials say that while the federal investigation is continuing, the evidence so far did not support civil rights charges against Wilson. The Justice Department later began its own civil rights investigation to examine whether the police in Ferguson have a history of discrimination or misuse of force. Now they have pictures of Michael Brown's diagram of his body. He was shot at the top of his head, in the eye, near the throat, in his above his right nipple, 3 and 4 times in his right arm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 marks. But one of them looks like the bullet skidded from his neck onto his face. So I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bullets, and they have a funny-looking belly button on the picture. A private autopsy requested by the family of Mr. Brown showed that he had been shot 6 times, 4 times in the right arm and twice in the head. I wonder if the officer was leaning backwards in his car or out of his car when he made a few of these shots. The autopsy was performed by Michael Baden, the chief medical examiner for the city of New York. Dr. Baden said one of the bullets entered the top of Brown's skull, suggesting that his head had been bent forward when it hit him and caused a fatal wound. No gunshot residue was found on the body, which would suggest that the rounds were not fired from very close range. However, Dr. Baden did not have access to Brown's clothing, which could contain residue. Local officials have not yet released their report on the initial autopsy, though a person briefed on the report said it showed evidence of marijuana in Brown's system. A third autopsy conducted by a military doctor as part of an investigation by the Justice Department also found that Mr. Brown was shot 6 times. Okay, I'm not going to get into how long the protests last, but it's been almost 100 days, if not 100 days. This is a city I did remember reading, and I'm just going to give sketchy details. I believe that 90% of the force, I think there's 53 officers on the force, and about 5 are not white. I do not have the statistics in front of me. Of the 53 commissioned officers in the Ferguson Police Department, 4 are black. I just confirmed that. I had memorized that fact 2 months ago. So, but the town itself is 70 to 80% black. In the dense portions of Ferguson, Missouri, in dark orange on the New York Times article, which indicates 75 to 80% black, I would say it takes up over 50% of the quadrant of the town. I'm just going to read one last quote, okay? Because I know that I heard on NPR a lot of people were interviewed, including a few Asians who had transplanted there from another part of the world. Ferguson, a town of 21,000, is relatively stable, working in middle-income community, but it does have pockets of disadvantage, said Rich Rosenfeld, a crime trends expert. Just because there's a dense black population doesn't mean there's going to be a proclivity for more crime, but St. Louis, Missouri does have a high crime rate in general, but usually suburbs don't. Now, Minneapolis is a highly integrated community of American blacks, Somalians, Ethiopians, and Liberians, and not all the crimes are racially divided in the sense that a crime is not committed just because somebody's angry based on what they're experiencing racially. But there is a tendency for people to commit crimes because of being disadvantaged and growing up in a culture where they feel gypped. Now, there's also white-collar crimes that are very scandalous that Larry Elder probably rarely mentions on his show. Crimes committed by white people that rip people off. And I'm sure he demonstrably exploits the situation with his words. I do have to work early in the morning. I have a real job. I don't just bitch about people on radio. So with that, I'm going to end the show. I do appreciate the increased volume of listeners. And I did want to clarify one last thing, which I iterated last night on my first volume of this topic. I don't care if you're black or white, Filipino, Thai, Alaskan, Canadian, Central American. We all have our own journey in this country, even me as a naturalized born citizen that came out of a suburb about the size of Ferguson, Missouri. White Bear Lake, Minnesota had 23,000 people. I was an all-star athlete. My goal was to eradicate the nation from racism. And that is why at age 19, I went to North Carolina and lived among black people because I believed that I could make a difference. When I got down there, I realized the black people didn't need me to save them. The top 10% of high school students attending North Carolina were from New York, New Jersey, rural parts of North Carolina, Virginia. They didn't need my salvation. They just needed, and they didn't even need me as a friend, but they accepted me as a friend because they could see what my sense of purpose was in that town. Maybe I did have high, lofty goals. Maybe I did want to be a white Al Sharpton or a Jesse Jackson at the time. But you know what? I went with good intentions. And I don't appreciate radio hosts that keep dividing the nation, whether it be Rush Limbaugh, Larry Elder, or other people. There is a serious philosophical rift in this country that keeps driving the two major political parties into disarray. I'm sorry that you could never take Barack Obama seriously or think that his community organizer background wasn't good enough for you. But you're part of the problem, folks, in the upper elite radio world. You're not part of the solution. So unless you're Jimmy Carter building Habitat for Humanity houses, you have no respect in my book. And if you want to date people with a checkered past, then forgive them and embrace them and become human yourself. Because I'm tired of your bullshit. Good night.